I tell that story because that defines the military so perfectly. In I did the right thing, you know, like doing the right thing, just scouting it out. I went out of my way to do the right thing, and it absolutely screwed me, which anyone that knows the military knows that that's exactly what happened. So, but anyways, other than that part, you know, I got there, but I remember being in basic training, and I just remember it was a river crossing. And I just remember like going through the river, coming out, and we were on this like river bank, and it was, I think it was nighttime. And like, I looked around and, you know, I mean, it's basic training, you know, but I just remember looking around, you know, and everyone's, you know, in uniform, you know, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm here. Like, I'm here. I've wanted to be here my whole life, and here I am. And
welcome to another edition of Kick Cage, and please give a warm welcome to Tyler Gray. Tyler, how are you, sir?
Good, good. Glad to be on here. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Obviously, you know, you've been in the public eye quite a bit. There is a bit of information about you out there, so I'm going to try not to cover stuff that's previously covered, you know, in podcasts and things like that. End up being a bit boring. So first of all, I want to talk about obviously being in special operations. It takes a certain person. Now, is it the environment that creates the person that goes into special forces, or is it in that person's DNA? Now, taking it back to your childhood, you didn't have the worst childhood, but you didn't have the best. Now, obviously, environmental, did that have an impact on where your life went? And if you'd had a different environment, do you think things would have ended up slightly different?
I'm gonna kind of break that into two. Yep. I'll start with just kind of the more overall nature versus nurture kind of yep. thoughts, and then I'll go in. Then I'll basically talk about it me personally. This is a subject I've thought a lot about. And I also do think it matters to a degree at what level. So not just the military, but even within special operations, you know, to me, the nature and nurture part of it gets more, it becomes more important depending on the units, that getting to the units or being in the units, for either way that we're talking about. So, you know, for the units that I came from, specifically the last unit, there's no way that you could make it there without certain attributes that are, I believe, genetic precursors, you know, the way, you know, brain, you know, the way your brain operates. Again, I don't know exactly what it is, but there's definitely things that are required, that you definitely are innate, that you have to get there. And the best way to say it is, you know, look at the Olympics. Okay. Doesn't matter. Let's use swimming. Everyone knows who Michael Phelps is. You know, if I swam from birth every single day and trained every single day from birth, I would not be as good of a swimmer as Michael Phelps. But it doesn't matter how much I want it. I wouldn't be. He genetically was, his body, and they've said this, like his body was designed for swimming, you know? So it's like in the Olympics, you know, those people are genetically have the characteristics that make them one of the best in the world in that sport. And then on top of that, they train their ass off for years and years and years with, you know, as a heart of work as you could put into anything to get to that level. So the Olympics, I think, is the best example of it's a combination. And it just, you wouldn't be able to get in the Olympics without some kind of combination between your intrinsic nature and your growing up environment and nurture.
Now taking it to yourself personally, then. Yeah, take it to yourself personally on that, then.
Yeah, so it's interesting because for me, you know, for me, people ask me, you know, why did you choose to join, so on and so forth. And I have said this before in another podcast, but it's like, I really don't feel like I ever had a choice.
Yeah.
It was so innate. It was so hardwired into me that, I mean, you know, you can see pictures of me as a kid. I mean, I lived, I ate, drank, and slept, you know, the military and, you know, the, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, the tactical environment.
Yeah.
As far back as I can remember, you know, I remember being probably like 7 or something like that. I mean, I remember we went to an air show at Edwards Air Force Base. And I mean, I went to like, and I never wanted to be in the Air Force, but you know, that was, you know, and then they had different like army recruiters had a set up, you know, there. And I mean, I would flip out. Like it's crazy to me how into that I was. And it was always like that. There was never a time that I chose it. It was always just something that I couldn't stay away from.
And where do you think that came from then? Was that from the guys on the block where you were growing up? Because there was a few veterans there. Would you think it came from that? Or is it, like you were saying, DNA based, something that was in your family genetics that pushed you?
So the only military thing I had was, like many my age, you know, my grandfather was in World War II. You know, they all were, you know. My dad was not a Vietnam veteran. He couldn't join to go to Vietnam because he had an active hernia at the time. And so they wouldn't let him in. But and if they did, knowing my dad, I know that I wouldn't be here today. So lucky for me. But so that was it. That was the only military thing I had was my grandfather. And but again, it was like there was no outside influence. It was just, and again, I know this sounds, but like, I'm pretty confident at this point, like, everyone, it's totally, and you can see this with certain interviews and stuff. It's like, you know, you find a singer, right? And it's like, you know, let's say it's a woman and she's like, I was born singing. Like I wanted to sing from fucking 2 years old, you know, she was born to do that. And we say that, and there's a lot of different things where we say, you know, oh, they were born to do that, born to do that, born to do that. I think that, and if you think of this logically, it makes total sense. But I think many people are born with the warrior mentality. That's just what they want to do. And I, by the way, I didn't want to go in the military. I wanted to go to war. Like I wanted to fight. That's what I wanted to do. And that was, and I really honestly think I was born that way. I also think going one level deeper, you know, if you look in, you know, I'm a student. Well, I try and study everything a little bit, but do you know anything about like evolutionary psychology?
Only a small amount of, yeah.
So basically for those that don't know, the concept is essentially, you know, that, we were, you know, born, basically our bodies right now are wired for the environment, you know, 10,000 years ago, and that evolution hasn't really caught up with where we are now. And if you study it again, for me, people, if they're religious, evolution itself, and this is a little off topic, but like people are like, evolution, and I go, well, why couldn't God have created evolution? You know, it's like, All right, yeah, they adapt over time. All right, cool. Like, to me, it doesn't contradict anything. I think they can both exist. That's my personal belief. But in every society, and you look at hunter-gatherer societies, in hunter-gatherer societies, it makes a lot of sense that some you know, boys and girls would need to be born with that warrior mentality, because the society needs that, right?
Yeah.
Why does society need it? Because, you know, especially back then, even today, look, you know, you get enough people together and someone's going to try and screw the other people over and take everything from them. That's just the way humans are built. We are built for war and we're built for violence. I'm not saying it's good, but when people kind of deny our intrinsic nature to be violent. Jordan Peterson speaks on this all the time, and he's much more eloquent than I, but you know, we're fundamentally born that way. And I believe that some people are born to do that, no different than some people are born artists. You know, everything that kind of exists today is needed for society to operate. And I personally want to normalize the concept of some people are just born with the warrior mentality and that's what they want to do. And I'm not saying, you know, I wasn't born tough. I wasn't born whatever. I just was born and wanted to go to war.
How did you feel once you went to the recruitment office and you started signing that paperwork? I mean, you didn't even choose an easy route. You went Ranger Regiment to start off with. Now, how did you feel when you were realizing, you know, what you were here to do? You were signing that and it was all becoming real.
Yeah. So, I mean, so what you're saying is important, because I think it's important to note that, you know, when I joined, by the way, I wanted to be was a Green Beret. Because of First Blood and Rampage.
Yeah.
You know, that was like prime time when I was growing up. There's a picture of me you guys can find online of me with a Rambo shirt on at the Mexican border, but Rambo 2. But, you know, for me, when I went in, I said, hey, I want to be a Green Beret. And at the time, there was no what's called the 18 X-ray contracts that didn't exist when I joined. That came in
baby SF one.
Baby SF, same yeah. thing. Yeah, that didn't exist when I joined. That came, I think, in 2001 or two. So, I said, you know, what's the hardest thing I can do? Nuclear technician was probably the hardest thing I could do. But what's the hardest thing I can do in combat arms? How close can you get me to special operations? And a Ranger contract was all that was available, and I was like, done. You know, I'll sign right now. And going with your earlier question, like, man, I was so excited, and that never really ended. You know, like, I remember being in basic training, and when you get to basic training, you go to this, for us, it was called 30th AG. It's like pre-basic training. You basically go there and have to get all your shots and you do tests. And that's actually when they shave your head and all this stuff. And then you go to actual basic training. You're there for like a week, you know, and it sucks. I would go as far to say it's like the worst place ever. It's like this purgatory of like, you're not in basic training yet, but you're now in the military. I'll give you, you know, let me tell you this story. I've never told this story and it's so funny. This is actually a great story. I can't believe I've never told this before. So I'm really happy that I remember this. So I joined out of the Hollywood recruiting office, Hollywood, California, literally across the street from Tower Records. That recruiting office is not there anymore. But so I joined out of Hollywood. I flew out of LAX and I had this meal voucher. Right. So it's like a meal voucher they give you. And it's like, I mean, it was, you know, it's like $30, you know, that basically they're giving you can use at the airport. So I fly. I forget where my layover is, but I didn't have a very long layover. I was flying to Georgia from L.A. and I had a little layover, I think, in Texas. And then I get to Atlanta, right? From Atlanta to Fort Benning, it's been a while. I think it's like 2 hours. I can't remember, 2-3 hours. And so I'll never forget this. So I get in, I'm at the airport, and I think my bus was like that I needed to be on, left at like, let's say 10 p.m. You know, I don't remember. So it left at like 10 p.m. And I'm there, and then I was going to get something to eat. I hadn't eaten. I missed, you know, I was starving. I was going to eat dinner. I had that meal voucher, and I was like, I'm going to eat something. And then being the, you know, the obvious thing to do was I'm going to go to where the bus is, just like you'd go to your gate and then go, okay, that's my gate. Cool. Now I'll go get something to eat. I'm like, I'm going to go find the bus, like that area, so I can say, this is where I need to go. Then I'll go get something to eat. Then I'll come back. So never forget this. Never forget this. So I go to the bus, and there's a bus there. And it's like, my bus was like 10. This is like, let's say 7. I don't remember. And I go to the bus, and I talk to the tour, and I'm like, hey, you know, is this the bus to Fort Benning? And the guy, you know, who was a civilian contractor, was like, yeah, it is, get in. And I'm like, oh no, I actually don't have to get on the bus till 10. I'm going to go get something to dinner. And he's like, you're in the army now, son, get your ass in here. And I was like, okay. And I, the entire drive, was starving. Like, I was so angry. And but that was it. You're in the army now, son, like, get in. You had no choice. Now, knowing what I know now, I could have been like, you know, piss off, I'm going to eat, I'll be back at 10, you know. Knowing what I know now, I could have just told him to pound sand. But yeah, we drove all the way there, and then I was there. I got there at like, I don't know, probably around 10. I was starving, and I didn't eat until the next day. I was so angry. I was so angry with that, but that's like almost, I tell that story because that defines the military so perfectly. In, I did the right thing, you know, like doing the right thing, just scouting it out. I went out of my way to do the right thing, and it absolutely screwed me, which anyone that knows the military knows that that's exactly what happened. So, but anyways, other than that part, you know, I got there. But I remember being in basic training, and I just remember it was a river crossing. And I just remember like going through the river, coming out. We were on this like river bank, and it was, I think it was nighttime. And like I looked around, and, you know, I mean, it's basic training, you know, but I just remember looking around, you know, and everyone's, you know, in uniform, you know, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm here. Like, I'm here. I've wanted to be here my whole life, and here I am. And don't get me wrong, again, everyone knows basic training sucks. Like, and I don't even just mean sucks from like, it's not that it's hard. It's just that it sucks. There's nothing fun about it. You're not learning cool stuff. You're learning basic stuff. You know, you're, you know, it's basic training. But I loved it, because that's what I wanted to do. And that carried me, you know, all the way through. You have to have, you know, like mental toughness. I was just having this conversation the other day. People talk about mental toughness. And I personally think that mental toughness is very hard to isolate on, if you could gauge someone's mental toughness outside of a specific test or event, which has to then be gauged to a degree on motivation. Is there mental toughness that you can test outside of the actual test?
Yeah,
I don't know. But for me, that, you know, was it mental toughness? I don't know. I would say what got me all the way through everything that I did was just, I wanted to do it so badly.
Would you say, you know, having the resilience, the mental resilience to go through all these demeanial tasks, because these tasks are designed to basically break you down so the army can rebuild you in how they want you. You know, making things as spotless, finding the littlest detail. If you can do it on a parade inspection, then you can do it out in the field and notice an enemy at like 400 yards. These are the reasons why they're doing those sort of things. So having that sort of mental resilience, do you think that was something you had before you hit the basic training as a precursor, or was that something that you was gathering bit by bit as you were being given these tasks?
So, I mean, I had a real problem with not just basic training, but anything related to what you're talking about, which is anything that was admin, shining your boots. Like, I was the guy that would be, that did the absolute minimum shining my boots. Absolute minimum. And look, I understand the concept of attention to detail. I get it. But I fought it my entire career. I really never, if it was admin stuff or if it was, cleaning, even making your bed. And I know there's, a great book about making your bed, but personally, I still call bullshit on it. I disagree. I don't think making your bed has anything to do with combat. That's my personal take. I don't think attention to detail. I think there are other ways that could teach it much better than teaching, drill and ceremony. And you got to understand too, drill and ceremony, marching, all that stuff. People say, oh yeah, now it's attention to detail and it's learning to do this and that. I call bullshit again. And the reason is that back when all this stuff was incorporated, marching was how they fought.
Yeah.
They marched in formation, got into a line, and DNC was also a combat tactic at the time, or a technique. And I don't think it applies today. And again, don't get me wrong. That is as military as military gets. I'm not saying it's unnecessary, but I am saying, the two units that I went to, if the regular military does DNC here, then, Ranger Battalion does it here. And then the next unit does it. In my entire time at my old unit, I think I was in formation twice. Two times total. We never did anything other than just formation twice. And it was for a graduation ceremony, which is a very big deal. And then the other was an award ceremony. That's it. Other than that, nothing. And my point being is that, that unit's as good as it gets in combat. So yeah,
where it matters,
that DNC is directly tied, it's like, no, it doesn't matter. And again, look, there's, I would say also maybe for the masses that, look, there's a method in the madness. And just because I don't agree with something doesn't mean it doesn't work for some people. Yeah. So I get it. I get the process, but for me, that was the hardest part of the military for me was admin stuff, because I just fought it tooth and nail because I didn't see how it related to combat. And if we spent time on anything that was not a combat skill, it just pissed me off. I remember doing EIB in Ranger Battalion, and you need it for, it's important for promotion and all this. But I remember we did EIB after September 11th, before our battalion deployed. And I lost my shit. Like, I was so pissed off. I was like, what does this have to do with it? Like, we're spending time, blah, 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 when we should be out in the mountains, rucking. And again, I still defend that. I still say, that I was right. But it's the military, and it's a big lumbering behemoth. And that big mechanism, that's why when you get to the more special units, the size comes down, and it really gives, there's just more leeway quite frankly. And that was, you know, I'll say this, the last unit I was in, I was told one time that, it's an army unit for men that hate the army.
That's a nice description.
There's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that. But again, I, that being said, when I was in basic training doing like drill and ceremony, I was all about it, you know, because, and I took it too seriously. I fully admit I took it too seriously, because I just, you know, marching was cool to me at that time because that was the military, you know.
Was there a male role model for you at this time while you were in the sort of basic training sort of phase?
Yeah, I had a drill sergeant that was in Range Battalion, and big African-American guy. You know, you have multiple drill sergeants, but like, he was like the guy that everyone looked up to and was like, that's, you know, that's the super soldier, you know? So I'll tell you a funny story about that. I've never told this story either. So that drill sergeant, at the time when I was in basic training, he was definitely in Ranger Battalion, and it was rumored that he was in the unit that I ultimately went to. And he didn't deny it. So it was whispered, you know, basic training was, oh, he was there. He did this. Like, he was just like the coolest guy. He was like a god to us. And cut to, you know, 6 years later, whatever it was. And I get to that unit and find out he was never there. Oh. You know, so it's pretty interesting. It's funny. I think he probably maybe went to the course and didn't make it. I don't know. It's just, it was funny, you know, because I saw that and I was like, oh, wow, that's so funny. It's like when you surpass your idols, it's a disappointing, it's just a weird moment when you like look up to somebody so much and then you realize that you've surpassed them. But yeah, that was my idol at the time. He was still, by far the best drill sergeant we had, and really did a good job, with new recruits and everything. But that was an interesting moment when I learned that, he actually, in fact, hadn't gone that far.
So moving forward, like you said, you talked about September 11th, and obviously you were getting you got deployed. You went to Afghanistan and Iraq later. Afghanistan wasn't very kinetic for you. How did you actually feel about that? So was it almost a disappointment to you, having that warrior inside of you, to not be as kinetic as perhaps you were imagining?
Yeah. Afghanistan was definitely disappointing. I learned a lot. I had some good experiences, but it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't the war experience I wanted, for sure. It was disappointing. At the time, though, too, it's like, I felt like we had missed the war there, the only big operation, the only like big military operation really was Anaconda, there was never prior to, even the invasion was smaller than Anaconda. So, I was definitely really upset that I missed Anaconda. And I remember listening to some of the snipers that were in Anaconda were just, you know, I remember one group, like, they ran out of ammo. They were smoking so many dudes. So yeah, I was definitely disappointed about that, which, by the way, is why when I came back from that trip, is why I decided to go to put in a packet to try and go to a different place, because I knew the smaller the unit, the more specialized the unit, just the more your chances were of being able to do something.
Yeah. Now, you went obviously to Iraq, and you were in Fallujah. The Marines were in there. They were getting an absolute pacing. And this was all after the...
The bridge.
The bridge incident, which... Terrible. Being in such an inflamed environment, the Marines were going in there thinking that they were just doing sort of almost a policing role. I interviewed Cody Alford, who was there at the time. What a story he had. You became obviously injured with your arm, which you've talked about, and you decided after a long period to medically retire.
Yeah. Well, that was a later deployment. That wasn't the Fallujah one, but yeah, it's the Fallujah thing. And then that was in a Baghdad rotation where we're doing assaults, but yeah, I decided to medically retire.
And that's the bit I also wanted to grasp on. It was your decision to medically retire. Taking that's a powerful thing, to make it your decision.
So, and this I can't remember if I've talked about, but basically what they said at the time, and people listening to this will understand my logic, but they'll also laugh at how wrong I was. And that is, I forget the numbers, but it was something like, you've got a 40% chance of going back to a team after 5 years. So 40%, less than half, and it might have been lower, I don't remember. Less than, I know it was less than half, because I remember just, half is like where we go, but less than half, you're like, less than half after 5 years. So this is 2006. So 5 years, 2011. Now you got to think of where things were.
Yeah.
Iraq was hot. I mean, hot as hot could be. Afghanistan, dead. Nothing was happening in Afghanistan in 2006. Right. So in my mind, I'm like, six more years. No way. I knew the tempo of what we were doing in Iraq. Like, I knew, Fallujah was over. All the main offenses were over. And it was just going after Zarqawi. Granted, he lasted longer than I thought he would. But I figured 2-3 years left in Iraq max. Afghanistan was already over with. So in my head, I'm like, I'm going to wait 5 years for a less than half chance. And then in 2011, there's going to be nothing going on, nothing. All the wars are going to be done. And up until that point, I'm going to have to be here watching all the teams deploy over and over again. I'm not going to be able to go. And then the war is going to be over by the time I get back to a team, if I can get back to a team. And I said this to, I forget who I said it to, but I said, like, look, I know that I am not strong enough to do that.
Yeah.
I fully admit that I couldn't do it. I would kill myself before I would watch teams do that and then go back after everything's done. Like, I can't do it. And so I said, I just got to get out. I got to get out of here. And what's funny for anyone listening to this is, little did I know that, Iraq would slow down by that time, but freaking Afghanistan was going to heat up again 10 times more than it originally was. Freaking ISIS wasn't even a word in 2006, Syria and the stuff in Africa. Little did I know, so I couldn't have been more wrong. But with the information I had, I had no way of knowing, and no one, I don't think anyone would have guessed, how much longer we would be in combat. No one would have ever suspected.
Let me just flip that situation on its head a little bit. Mm-hmm. How do you think you would have felt or even coped if the decision had been taken out of your hands? If you would have been told that you were being medically retired, how do you think you would have coped?
Well, So it's interesting because it's so let's think of it this way. If it was out of my hands, they told me, I think at the time I would have been very upset about it, but they were great about it. I mean, they offered me to go into the R&D section. I mean, they gave me all kinds of options of what I could do. And I would have been, I love that stuff. I would have been great at it. I know I would have been great at it. And I would have been helping the effort. So I fully admit that I was selfish, not contributing and just getting out. That was an absolute selfish decision. Because I just knew it would have eaten me alive. But had they have told me that I was going, you know, had they forced my hand, I probably would have been upset to not have that control. But now, cut to, let's say, now, I mean, knowing what I know now, I absolutely could have gone back to a team. I would have had to have, you know, there's still things I wouldn't have been able to do as good. No question, but I could have done the job for sure. Couldn't have been a breacher, you know, something little, you know, minute skills, but I could have done it. So what's interesting now, and it's been like this for years, is now I know I could have gone back. Now I know that ISIS, Syria, Afghanistan, all these things freaking were, have, you know, happened. So now I look back and I have to accept that I pulled the plug on myself when I could have gone back and when there were many more wars to go to. I chose that. So that's a hard pill to swallow now because it was my choice.
I don't know. I think that's always going to be a difficult thing when you're looking back on a life-affirming decision with hindsight, having different data in front of you now to what you did then. And perhaps that's almost, that could almost be a dangerous game.
It is. And I don't play it. I'm aware, like I said, but I am not upset with myself because I did what was best at the time based on the information I had.
Yeah. You know, going home, you're in a relationship at this time. And you said you sort of reached out and they were saying that you had PTS. And you're saying, well, it's a catch-all thing because, you know, like everyone knows, you can get PTS from many, many different things. And it's funny that you also mentioned on a different podcast, LTS, a lot. The loss of traumatic stress, that you actually seek chaos. Now, you were saying during this time, it wasn't too bad. It was when your partner left and you sort of spiraled at that point.
Yeah.
Do you think that she was seeing something in you before you noticed it? Were you displaying characteristics externally of clinical depression before you admitted it to yourself?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, yeah. Without question. Yeah, without question.
Because you listening to another podcast, I know that you two have spoken since.
Yeah.
Have you spoken about that period of time, and perhaps you have, and have you spoken about how she saw you externally?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hadn't, you know, we stopped talking. And this is years after we kept trying, you know, and anyways, and then she moved on and I didn't talk to her literally not a word for 7 years, nothing. And I, during that 7 years, like, my heart was broken. Like I had nightmares about the situation. Like it was, it fucked me up for 7 years without question. And I tried everything, therapy, freaking, you know, I got into another relationship. Like I I really did, I can honestly say, except maybe like, you know, the big kick right now on like, on, what are they called? Hallucinogenics and stuff. Other than like ayahuasca, I tried everything. Yeah. And it wasn't a thing back then, but, nothing worked. Nothing worked. I still was just torn apart about it. And so I just sent her an email and, or a Instagram actually, and just kind of said, hey, like, you know, my literally it said something to the effect on, I no longer hate you, which I can't believe she responded to, but I mean, I really, that's how bad it was at that time. And anyways, we ended up talking, and we talked, you know, later about that, the time period you're talking about. And, you know, and I told her, I said, you know, I cannot believe, I, you know, I appreciate how, you know, cause she dealt with me in that state for like 3 years. And I mean, I was clinically depressed for 3 years. I was going through surgeries. I was not in a good headspace, and she tried for those 3 years. And then finally it takes its toll. Yeah. So yeah, we talked about it. And really it was me telling her, you know, cause I was fucking hated her for 7 years. It was really me telling her that I'm sorry that I had such a hatred towards you. You did so much for me. You tried so hard, and I've never given you credit for it. And, it was really me just apologizing and owning up to the mistakes that I made, and giving her credit for how hard she tried.
You know, taking ownership of your mental health is something that else that you've said. When it comes to sort of medical professionals, especially civilian professionals, they're not going to know what you've experienced. They're not going to know what's going on in your head. It's very much a 9-inch paintbrush, and we're all going to paint you with the same coat of color. Hence why, you know, they're saying you've got PTS. Well, tell me what the symptoms is. No, that's not what I've got. You started researching your own symptoms and going down a bit of a rabbit hole yourself of saying, well, what caused this? I'm feeling this way. What's caused it? And obviously chemical, biological impulses and everything from the brain to hormones, you looked into it. And I found that quite fascinating that you took that responsibility on yourself to almost fix yourself.
So what you just said but it's a fact. And it's a fact that people have to accept, which is you and only you are responsible for fixing yourself. You and only you are ultimately responsible for your physical health, mental health, everything. You are the responsible person. And the problem, especially in Western society, is we go, oh, it's a doctor. They know what's best for me. They don't. Why? Because they're not you. And just because they're a doctor, look, it's a job. They can only care to the limits of their job. They have 500 other patients. You are your only patient. You should be an expert on you. You should learn about all these things because, and again, this is what I'm about to say is true, whether it's for mental health or physical health. Yeah. It's like how many people have, you know, I mean, cancer is a very popular one where, you know, the doctors will say this, you know, the doctors say this doesn't really work out. And then somebody does their own research and then they find this, and then they go to the doctor and go, what about this? And then the doctor goes, oh my God, yeah, it's that. The doctor would have never found it had they not done their own research. The stories are that they're common for a reason. And that reason is you have to be your own and I'm going to say doctor, and I don't mean that as like, you know, but you are your own freaking patient advocate. Like, you are ultimately the head of the freaking hospital, right? Yeah. Like, you have to do research, because if you don't, you're putting all the responsibility for your physical and or mental health in someone else's lap. That, quite honestly, and this is nothing against doctors or the mental health profession in general, but they're never going to care as much as you do. It's not possible. And quite frankly, nor should they. If they care more than you do, there's a fundamental problem. Like, that's your most basic problem, is you don't love yourself. That's step one. So you have to take ownership that you are responsible for all aspects of not just your health, but your life in general. It's all on you. And if you don't take that responsibility serious, then you're really never going to get the care you need, because the care that you need for yourself comes from yourself.
Do you think also that, especially tier one operators, people who have served in SEALs, in Delta, in even Rangers, in these high alpha male environments, do you feel that perhaps when it comes to, you know, checking such a thing as testosterone levels, which, you know, can be a thing that will affect your mental health? Because it's such an alpha male environment, do you think they go, I'm not going to get that checked, I'm not going to talk about that?
Yes, I think it's a it'll come to my head, but I think it's what is that word? I agree with you, and the world word will come to me, but I think what it is for, you know, some people maybe don't want to look into, and let's just use test for an example. It's like, you know, especially in a super alpha male type environment, you know, those people are not going to want to admit that a number of a chemical, of a hormone, can define aspects of their personality, or could define, quite frankly, literally, their mental toughness at a given time. They don't want to admit that. So yeah, I think it's definitely it's definitely an area that's kind of taboo, because people want to feel like they're them outside of, oh, you know, my hormones, you know, are, you know, don't matter. You know, I'm a tough guy. You know, I don't care what my testosterone number is. I'm tough. And the reality is, that's a major component. And again, anyone who wants to disagree with that, you know, they're wrong. And there's some things I'll say, oh, it could go either way. No. That's wrong. You at a testosterone level 50 and you at a testosterone level 800 are two radically different people.
Yeah.
Not just, and literally radically different in how you feel, how you act, how you think, night and day. And anyone who disagrees with that, freaking go try it. Go try, figure out how to drop your testosterone, see how you act, how you feel, and then get it back up. Or conversely, if you're just not quite feeling like yourself, and again, I have no problem saying this. Like, I got on testosterone replacement therapy. I did it for years, and I did it because there was some piece missing that I didn't feel like myself. And I was like, you know, I have like this willpower, and I've had all these things that I know are me, but I just felt like it's like I couldn't activate it, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
It's like I could kind of, it wouldn't kick in like it normally would. So I went and got tested. I don't remember the number I was at, but it was like 100. It was very low. I mean, it wasn't low. It was very low. And then I started getting the therapy done and the replacement therapy. I don't actually remember how long it took. Maybe a week. I really don't remember. But when that number went, you know, up to, you know, 750 or whatever it was, I've never gone, you know, some people go 1100. That's not me. But at, you know, the 700, which I never tested it when I was in my 20s, you know, before I got hurt. But based on how I feel and how I think, like, I'm pretty sure it was about there. And I played with it to get it to where I'm like, okay, this is me. This is my normal level. It was night and day. It was night and day. And was it humbling? Absolutely. It was absolutely a punch in the face that this hormone was the difference between me feeling like of just a shadow shell of myself and myself. Yes, that was a punch in the face. It was a punch in the face and it was a hard pill to swallow. But it was also awesome because that was a component that was missing. And when I, you know, yeah, it's a hard pill to swallow, but once I did that, suddenly I felt like myself again. And things were so hard, like to be motivated to do something, were suddenly easy like they used to be. Yeah. And here's the thing. Now it's so obvious to me. I was working out twice a day. I had a job that was obviously extremely active.
Yeah.
I got blown up. I didn't work out for literally 5 years. I was doing surgeries for, I think, 2.5, 3, I forget exactly. And then after that, I was doing physical and occupational therapy, which was basically going into the doctor's office or the rehab place and playing Connect Four. I shit you not, it was miserable. And then finally I did that for maybe a year. So it was maybe 4 years. And then I was just like, I'm going to the gym. And this is a true story. I remember very clearly the first day I went to the gym and with my right arm, I couldn't pick up the 20-pound dumbbells. I couldn't pick them up. And I didn't, but I wanted to cry. Like, I wanted to cry. It was at 24-Hour Fitness in Las Vegas. And then I went to the bench and I had to do the bar. 45-pound bar. I had to do that. Yeah. And I still struggled on my right side to get it up. And man, that was tough. I mean, that was tough. And it took me about a year before I really could even work out. Like, if that makes sense. It was a year of just doing very, very low weight just to get my arms structure able to, you know, to handle it. And that, man, and you know, I've had people ask me about working out and they're like, does it hurt your arm? You know, and I go, yeah, every time. Yes, of course it does. Look at it. Yeah, it's every time. It doesn't stop me from doing it, but yeah, it does hurt. And there's a critical point in that, and this is with all injuries or even age, quite frankly, and that is there's a difference between pain that is discomfort and pain that is a signal of a mechanism of injury.
Yeah.
Okay. Some of the, you know, the pain I experience is just my body going, you shouldn't be doing this. It's not smart. And I go, I know. Then there's every once in a while I'll do something and it's like it, you know, it slaps me with a real pain where I'm like, yeah, it's gonna mess me up. You know what I mean? And yeah. I now know that it's very obvious to me the difference between the two. But you know, when you're coming back from an injury, I had knee surgery, ACL, MCL tear in 2000, like, yeah, it was extremely painful rehab, to get my knee back. And again, it's just, you just have to know the difference between the pain that is your body resisting and the pain that is causing further or new injury. And, Yeah. So that for me, it took me a long time to work out, and I actually didn't do the test thing right away. So going kind of putting the two timelines together, I think I worked out for, I don't know exactly, maybe it was like, actually it might've been a full year before I figured out kind of the testosterone piece, which really wasn't based on the physical working out. That was completely based on mental. But then obviously they both, you know, it was definitely easier without question to lift once I had solved that. And it just, you know, I just felt better. I had more energy. I mean, again, look at, if anyone doesn't know this, look up the side effects of low testosterone and get yours tested. And when I say get yours tested, I don't mean testosterone. Get a full blood and hormone panel. Okay. Testosterone is, it's an important hormone, but they're all important, and they all, you know, a doctor, a hormonal doctor really needs to see the whole picture. They need all the pieces. You know, that one number isn't the end all be all number. And they can really, and the key too, by the way, again, just so we're very blatant about it, is it's balance. Yeah. You need to have balance. And you know, when my testosterone was 100, that was not balance, you know, but, oh, so to finish the part. So I got hurt working out every day, twice a day, didn't work out for 5 years. Maybe it was four. I don't remember exactly. And then I started working out again. And then, you know, 6 months or whatever, I basically just based on the mental health figured out that something was off, went and got that tested, and then got on the replacement therapy. And I did that for, I don't know, 3-4 years. I don't know how long it was, but it was a long time until we had a mechanism for my body to produce it naturally again. And I still take supplements for that. Yeah. You know, just like I take supplements for, you know, all kinds of stuff, but there's no shame in that game. And, there's definitely a stigma. And I am here to basically tell, and again, women, you know, same thing, you know, hormones are important. And it's, you know, estrogen is the female testosterone. Yeah. I mean, ish. but again, get all of your hormones tested. If you don't feel, if you've tried everything and on how you feel, and you just kind of ran out of things to try, try your hormones. Men and women, both, they're the same level of importance for both.
Well, I think when it comes to women, it's been more acceptable, especially when they reach the menopause, that they go on HRT, hormone replacement therapy. That has been a big thing for decades. But when it comes to men, and, you know, thinking about testosterone, it's just the male version of that. You need to have a certain level to be cognitive, for your muscular function, to be awake during the day and live your life.
So I'm going to say something extremely controversial.
Go for it.
But it will prove a point.
Yep.
How important are hormones, both estrogen and testosterone? How important are they? How important are they? I will use an example, very controversial. Okay. I am not making any statements on this entire subject at all. But it's a big deal right now, the whole trans community.
Yeah.
Okay. There are women that choose to become men and men that choose to become women, or, you know, try and become whatever. I don't want to get into conversation, but whatever. There's women that try and become men and they start taking testosterone.
Yeah.
There are men that want to become women and they start taking estrogen. Here's my point that I'm bringing. I'm not getting into that conversation. What I am saying is the effect is unbelievable. If you're, you know, a guy that starts taking estrogen will grow boobs. Like, really think about that. That's insane. You know, that's insane. And start taking on all these female qualities. Again, are they women? No. But they start taking on these female characteristics.
Yep.
a woman that wants to become a man starts taking on the testosterone, they start taking on male characteristics, right? Their jaw gets big. It's like, I mean, and again, not swinging into that debate, but those are facts. They start taking those qualities. So where I'm going with this is, if that's a fact, like that they're taking, you know, again, I think the guys going, growing boobs is like the most blatant. If a guy can take estrogen and grow boobs, you got it. Like, if that doesn't say how powerful hormones are, I don't know what, that, you know, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, yep.
We know that, I mean, that's the power of it. Not swinging into that debate, but like, that's how powerful hormones are. Now, you know, are those absolute extreme examples? Yes. And regardless of that debate, do I think that's healthy? Fuck no. You know what I mean? Like, that's, again, hey, people want to do what they want to do. They can do what they want to do, but it's not healthy. And but it goes to show you that for a guy, you know, that testosterone, also, if you take testosterone, you can, like, I'll tell you, when I first started taking testosterone, I had a, and I forget what happened, but it basically shot my estrogen up, and I would cry.
Yeah.
And I forget why, but anyways, when I went to the doctor, he goes, oh yeah, you know, whatever you're, you know, cause I just started doing it or whatever, but it was raising both testosterone and estrogen. So then he put me on an estrogen blocker. Suddenly I could watch a puppy die and I wouldn't cry. You know, it's like, holy shit, this is crazy. You know? And it's like, but it just, again, the power of hormones, if you've never, you know, if you've never, it's just like I tell people about, you know, people debate the power of, you know, like medications, like how strong medications are, you know, you know, my joke is, if you don't think you can take something and it can fundamentally alter your state of mind, take acid and let me know what you think afterwards. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, the possibilities are, people, you can't underestimate the power of some of these things. And don't get me wrong, you have to be very careful in what you take and how you take it and all these different things, but just understanding that there is a brain chemistry balance in your mind, and hormones are part of that, and nutrition is part of that. Again, research it on your own, learn, because it is a major component. The brain operates within the body. Fact. So your mental health should never be viewed as something separate than your physical health, because
very true. Very true.
Because it's the same. Your brain is operating on what you put into it physically. Again, not debatable. Yet Western medical community doesn't treat it that way. So it's like, with mental health, when I talk to people about mental health, I will not talk about mental health without also talking about physical health, because they're the same thing.
They go one hand in hand.
The best way to say it, I think, right now, is like, Western medicine and all of that is like, is jujitsu, karate, kung fu, you know, aikido, you know, ninjutsu. There's all these, it's like the medical community, all the doctors are like masters of one art, but the real solution is MMA. It's a mixed solution of, you have to know a little bit about all of those, because they all go together to create, they all go together, because ultimately the reason all those styles exist is because there's similarities and differences when two humans are in a physical conflict with each other, no differently than all the different medical pieces go together, and all integrate with each other, because we're humans and we have a body and the mind operates within it in this environment. And You have to know a little bit about all of them to have an integrated solution for yourself.
You need that sort of mosaic of information and knowledge. Do you think that's why veteran foundations, veteran companies such as Marcus Capone and Vets and Warrior Hearts Healing, do you think that's why there was a need for these sort of foundations?
I'll say it this way. I know Marcus, and I know Tom Spooner from Warrior's Heart. I've actually been to Warrior's Heart, and I've went and did Marcus's thing in Mexico. So I've done them both. And the thing that I think I told Marcus this, I can't remember, but you know, for me, it's, I believe that the, and again, I'm going to make a very big term here, but like the issues that the veteran community is facing, combat or not combat, the overall issues, they have to be solved by one of us because we know what the problem is.
Yeah.
It's unrealistic for us to think that a team of doctors who were never in the military and never experienced combat, and never experienced all these different things, which create the unique problem. It's unrealistic to think that they're going to find a solution. How could they? They don't know exactly what it is. And yet, because the way we operate is they're a professional. I'm going to, you know, hey, here's my problem. Help me. No. They don't know. They don't know what you know. So to me, and this is why I do things like this, it's on us. It is our responsibility to fix ourselves. And then once something has worked for you, for me, then it's my responsibility to give that information to others so they can see if it works for them. But then the responsibility to take that information and apply it to themselves is still on you.
On them. Yeah.
On you. On you. But that's great. That's great. It's great because if the responsibility is on someone else, you have no control over that.
Yeah.
You're at their whim. Okay. If I put all the responsibility for my health at the VA, then I'm giving them all the power. As soon as I go, you know what? No, I am going to take charge and I am going to be my advocate and I'm going to study these things. And I'm going to figure out the problem and I'm going to figure out where to go. As soon as you take that into your hands, you now have the power. You have the power to fix you. And the key is you're never going to be fixed until you do that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was also going to sort of add to that. Being fixed, it's a continual journey. I've found personally when it comes to my own development after my struggles, I've come to the conclusion that I'm never going to be the person I was before what happened. So I embrace this new person who's in front of me, but I've also come to the realization that I'm never going to be, you know, 100% fixed. It's going to be a continued journey throughout, I feel personally.
No. You are 100% correct. 100% correct. Make no mistake. I am not fixed. Yeah. I am better than I was. I'm better today than I was yesterday. I'm way better than I was a year ago. I'm way, way better than I was 3 years ago. But the best you will ever be, if you continue to work on yourself, is the second before you die. That's reality, you know?
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, yeah, it is a forever journey. You are never fixed. So again, when I say fixed, I really mean, you're never fixed. You are forever a work in progress. That being said, I will use fixed to say like my self-worth issue. I still work on it. But definitely fixed the main mechanism, which was I had no self-worth. I have fixed now accepting that I do, and I still work on it and add to it. But I like using fixed in like big, you know, it's like you can fix like the biggest thing I always say is you can't fix a problem that you don't know exist.
Yeah.
step one is always figuring out what the problem is, and then you can address it. And then, you know, fixed for me is I can't really do any work now going back. Now it's all just work going forward.
Yeah.
To me, it's like, okay, I've fixed the past part of it, and now it's about maintaining and learning going forward. But absolutely correct. You're never fixed. That's not the right word. But one thing you said, or not, but in addition, what you said is I would say it's impossible to overstate how important this saying is. And that is, so many people say, you know, I just wish I could get back to the old me. I just, you know, I need to get back to the place I was, but before X event, before X relationship, before whatever X is, right?
Yep.
And if anyone here listening is doing that, I just need to get back to where I was. I just need to get back to how I was at this time. It could mean mentally, it could be physically, it could be financially, it could be a million different things. Stop. Because it is literally impossible. You can never go backwards. And if that's your focus, that is exactly what's keeping you from going forwards. I will never be the person I was before I got blown up. It's literally, we can't go back. But that's okay.
Yeah.
And that, to say I just want to get back to that, is actually making a fundamental mistake, which is assuming that that pre-you is better than the you now. If X, solve for X, it's algebra, right? If X is a traumatic event, again, it could be your spouse cheated on you and divorced you. It could be a car accident. It could be a million things. All of those things are very traumatic. Traumatic events make us grow. I would not be who I am today without the trauma of this fact. And I'm pretty fucking strong in a large part because of the things I learned about myself through that. So I would argue no one was stronger prior to trauma. If you're still here and the trauma happened, you are stronger than you were before it. You just don't realize it. Because what you want to get back to is not strength. What you want to get back to is ignorance. And ignorance is never anything but a weakness. So this is very key. Do not try and go backwards. Take whatever happened. You are now stronger. Accept it and move on, that you're now going to be the new version of yourself, which is, with that trauma, stronger than the ignorant version. And it's okay. It's okay to never go back to who you were. And not only it's not okay, that's like somebody in their 50s going, if I could just be the person I was in my 20s. I'm 46 now. In my 20s, I was a fucking idiot. So many things I thought that were just wrong, not true. Like, I don't want to go back there. I was a dumbass. And here's the best part. How I am right now, when I'm 70, me at 46, I'll know that right now, 90% of the stuff I think is absolute stupidity and lunacy. And I'll know so much more then. But I don't know that now. So, hey, I do the best I can with the information I have. And that is our entire life. It'll never change. We're always works in progress. And all you can do is keep making the best decisions with the information you have at the time. And then not judging yourself for the decisions you made with the information at the time.
Yeah.
You made the best decision, go with it. And just stop judging yourself for the past, because it's unchangeable and it's unchangeable, and it was based on what you knew then.
And I think that beautifully circles back to your decision and the mindset for medically retiring. So that's beautifully gone in a wonderful circle. Obviously, we touched on veteran startups, veteran foundations, and things like that. And obviously, during SEAL Team, people notice wonderful Easter eggs like the Eagles and Angels hats that are, worn, and also the C4 Foundation patch from Earth that was worn by now, obviously, who has the idea to put these actual foundations and charities and veteran startups in the show?
The short answer is it depends. I mean, it depends on what, you know, what you're talking about specifically. Like, I mean, Eagles and Angels, I was on a team with Tom, who owns Eagles and Angels. I know Tom very well.
I've spoken to him a couple of times.
He's a great guy. And so I know him well. So like, I think I had gotten a hat, but here's what's funny. So it's like, I had gotten hats from him, but then somebody wore a hat, maybe AJ or Max, I'm not sure, maybe David, I don't know, wore an Eagles and Angels hat that didn't even come from me. It came from someone else. So it's like, that was purely on, I forget what it was. I think everyone's done it at one point. I think David's worn one, AJ's worn one, and Max has worn one. Yeah, I know Tom and I've gotten some stuff, but they've also on their own gotten stuff and put it in there. The C4 Foundation, I think, came from Justin, if I'm not mistaken. And then there's, you know, there's been a ton of other stuff. You know, AJ has some stuff from Forged.
Forged.
Neil has worn some stuff from, I forget what, but Remy Adelke's clothing, I can't think of the name of it, but so really everyone on the show is, you know, it's at least the actors all kind of have their little thing. David's worn 30 seconds out shirts, you know, so it's everyone just kind of, you know they connect with somebody and they're like, oh hey, do this. And so it's, we've been very lucky that CBS has allowed us, or well, Paramount Plus now, that they've allowed us to do that. And it, you know, it makes it realistic because that's, you know, what you would be doing. But it's also great that we get to put those organizations out there. I put in an episode or in a season, actually, the flag that I made at Warrior's Heart, which I still need to auction off. But I put that in the talk above the monitor. So it's in a whole season, I think season 5. They've been very cool allowing us to, you know, kind of put some real organizations that are all personal to us and put them in there.
I think it's been a fantastic show for the basis of highlighting issues such as TBIs, PTS with Raise Ordeal, but also having the sort of Easter eggs of real foundations and real clothing lines sort of put in there for people who are keen to, you know, support veteran charities and foundations, which I think is absolutely brilliant. And you know, I take a hat off to that mentality from the show's producers and creators, which obviously you're now producing and direct. Just a couple of questions that obviously we're running towards the end of the interview. A couple of questions that I would like to drop in. One of them is, I understood from a previous podcast that you, when you were asked about your arm in bars in certain situations, you would never actually say that it was something you did in combat. Thinking back, what would have been the most outlandish, funniest story you told somebody who had come up to you and asked you about your arm at the time?
That's actually really funny. I have two of them, actually. One was, so the girl I was dating at the time was a stripper. So I used to go to the strip club all the time. And if I got a, every once in a while, anyways, this girl came up and asked me about my arm. And again, this is, you know, within 2 years of it happening, which was, I mean, it was, if you looked at me and met me, your focus would go right to it. It was super pink. It was very obvious that, you know, it doesn't blend. It didn't blend like it does now. So they would notice right away. Now I've talk with people that I just met and they don't even realize it, you know, until it's brought up later, you know, whatever. But I told her that it was a shark bite. And so I have these two, which I don't think you'll be able to see.
Yeah, can see them. Yeah,
tooth scars. So that's from when it was. I had an external fixator. So because the bone was through the skin, they drilled. I won't be able to see it there, but they basically drilled screws in here, and then they had this metal thing that was. It's basically an external way to immobilize your arm because you can't have a cast because you have an open wound, which my whole arm was an open wound. So I told her it was a shark, and I was like, you know anything about sharks? And she's like, no. And I'm like, it was a bucktooth shark. And it put its two teeth right in here, you know, and then it slid, you know, released, and then it grabbed it. And I think I had my buddy there, and he was like crying at the time. But yeah, the bucktooth shark story, that's I'll never forget that. So the second story, though, this one's crazy. That was funny, but this one's insane. So I was doing, it was at the time I was doing Go Ruck, and we were in New York City. I don't remember what an event we were for or there for. I went to eat at some restaurant in New York City, and this is just so odd. And it was, I had a jacket on, you know? And there's no way this was planned ahead of time, but we go and the host was like, you know, going to sit us. And I don't know, it was like six guys. And he was like, hey, can you guys do me a favor? You know, can you guys, and I think we were doing an event, you know, whatever. He's like, can you guys, when you get your server, he is deathly afraid of sharks, like freakishly afraid of sharks. Can you tell him that you were in the East River? And I forget exactly the details, but you saw a shark. And I'm going, oh, I'm like, oh, I got something for this guy, right? So we sit down and this guy comes up. And again, there's no way anyone knew this. And I took my jacket off and he came up and they started kind of going on about, you know, we saw sharks. And he really got kind of freaked. Oh my God, you saw a shark? And then I went, dude, I got bit by one. And I go, and this guy, I don't know what the issue was. You know, maybe it was a phobia, or maybe he had to go in the East River like in the next week for some, I don't know. But he freaked out. Like he became white. And what's funny is the host, there's no way he knew that I'll never forget. I was like, what are the odds? I mean, who goes and who says that to a group of people? Hey, mess with this, your waiter about a shark. But yeah, I freaked him out. And what's funny is we left and I never told the host that I even like, you know, that I even like, you know, showed him like an arm injury. So, but yeah, he got like white. He was really freaked out. I never got the full context of what he needed to, you know, why he was so scared or what he needed to do. I don't know. But yeah, those are my favorite thing that I would tell people is a shark bite. You know, and I mean, if you look at it, you know, on the grand scheme of, you know, possibility, it looks like it could be that way. You know,
my last final quick question is, if you had to choose, would you choose between A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, or Return of the Jedi?
Oh. All right, so the book answer is Empire. That's like the book answer.
Yep.
But, I'll give you a but. Empire is the better film. It's the better film.
Yeah.
But A New Hope is basically three films in one. If you think about it, three movies in one movie. You got the entire, you know, beginning story in Tatooine. Or not Tatooine, freaking, oh my God. where Lucas from. And then you've got the, you know, the raiding the Death Star.
Yeah.
Then you've got the attack on the Death Star. And it's really three separate movies in a way, you know, it's three like very different pieces. And the fact that it works in the time that it does, I mean, just think of it, think of how long Avatar is and think of how long A New Hope is. And it's three movies in one. I mean, it is a clean edit. It's a flawless movie. So Empire is the movie I like more. It's the darker movie. It's the better film. But I would argue that New Hope is the more difficult film to make, if that makes sense.
Good answer.
You know what I mean? It was a harder film to make. Also of note, George Lucas didn't direct Empire. A lot of people don't know that. George Lucas did not direct Empire Strikes Back, which is why it has the darker tone to it. It's the only one of the first three he didn't direct. That being said, I'm going to add another layer to it. Return of the Jedi is, you know, it's got Ewoks, you know, so it's like, you know, but so it's definitely the more kid friendly of the three. At that time, I assume Harrison Ford was so coked up that it's pretty, if you watch it, it's pretty obvious in his, you know, in his portrayal. He's definitely like an ultra Han. I mean, it's obvious in that movie, but, and I'm like the biggest Harrison Ford fan ever. But if you just look at Return of the Jedi as a script, it is a very, very well-written movie. Yeah. The script is much better than, it's like the film has like the most kid, you know, all these different things. But if you just look at everything that they incorporated into from the first two into the third one, it is exceedingly well-written, you know? So I would say it might be, to incorporate everything they did, the scene with the, you know, like he saves his dad, you know, the combination of the sister, like everything, it's very well written. Even, you know, it's the opening scene is so good with, you know, it's, you know, Luke is so weak in one, you know, he's a whiny little bitch. In two, you know, it's like, okay, he starts getting better. And then when three opens, like, he's just the baddest dude ever. So confident. And, you know, it's just all these things. I really, the only negative thing actually, yeah, Boba Fett got done dirty in three. You know, it's so dirty in three. I don't know how George Lucas messed that one up, but that's my, I mean, Empire's, you know, the opening of Empire is like the greatest opening of a movie all time. I love Empire Strikes Back, but A New Hope is, I think, like in the grand scheme of movies, they did the impossible with that movie.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I feel like we could have another podcast in itself, just me and you talking about Star Wars and, sequels. I reckon we could easily do that. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you for coming on. It's been brilliant. Getting into to your mindset. Thank you very much indeed. It's been fun.
Thanks for having me, man. Take it easy.
You too.
All right. Have a good one. Bye, guys.
What's up, everybody? I'm Jason Lilly, prior Marine Raider, Recondo, Marine Sniper. Please catch me and my boy here on the next episode of Kick Cage. You'll like it, I promise.